The Vietnam War, it's over. Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, hello. I'm Rob Wolf, and I'm glad you're taking some time out of your busy schedule to join me for an episode of New Books in Science Fiction and Fantasy, where you get to spend some time with authors to hear what they're thinking, learn a little about what they're writing, and hopefully get some insight into what makes them tick. Today, we're stepping lightly into the fantasy realm, and I say lightly because my guest today, Porochista Kakpor, has written a book, The Last Illusion, that isn't a traditional fantasy book with queens and wizards and empires to be won or lost, but it is fantastical in many ways, and like many fantasy books, it's inspired by classic legend. This is Ms. Kakpor's second novel. Her first, Suns and Other Flammable Objects, was a New York Times editor's choice. Her nonfiction has been widely published, and she's taught writing at lots of top-notch colleges and universities. And I'm super glad, after a few scheduling postponements, that we finally have a chance to talk. So welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's dive in. The main character in The Last Illusion, Zal, shares a name and many characteristics with a hero from a medieval Persian epic called the Book of Kings, which I understand you're very familiar with, having been born in Tehran and hearing tales from the Book of Kings from your parents when you were a kid. So I was hoping you could talk a bit about the mythic Zal, what drew you to him, and how you've adapted your own Zal after the myth.
Yeah, great question. In the Book of Kings, you have so many stories. I mean, there's just, I want to say hundreds of stories that you could pick from. It's a giant, giant book with 50,000 couplets in it. So it wasn't like, you know, I think every Iranian knows, has a favorite, let's say, story from that epic. But Zal is a pretty prominent figure. Now, he comes in and out of a few different stories. But for me, he was by and large my favorite because I was, you know, I encountered him when I was a young immigrant to this country. And he had this sort of outsider narrative that sort of culminated in a sort of optimistic grand finale. He was basically a young feral child. He was tossed out into the forest by his family, his royal family, and he was left to be raised by this giant bird, the Simurgh, who's this great mythical benevolent bird of Persian legend with this wingspan that takes up the sky, you know, really, really kind of a grand and strange figure. And so he was raised in a forest and you know, raised kind of wonderfully, better probably than if he had been raised by humans, because he ended up having, in some way, almost a superhuman strength. He was very strong, and he was later spotted in the forest by his family, basically, and brought back to ancient Persia to become this great you know, warrior of the ancient Persian kingdom. So he was kind of brought back from his estrangement, essentially, and it all turned out quite well. So I loved the story. I thought it was both kind of, you know, magical, obviously, the idea of a young boy being raised by a bird, but the idea that it would turn out well and that he could have it both ways and exist in this supernatural realm of sorts and then also go back into a sort of terrestrial world and still succeed, that really wowed me.
And so Yorzal, the connection to birds for him, it's not a place of strength. It is almost a something he's trying his whole life to overcome. And I wonder if maybe you could explain, you know, why you went in that direction with the story, and maybe just tell a little bit about the plot of the story for listeners who, you know, who aren't familiar with your book.
Sure. So there's the whole story of Zal from the Book of Kings that I always wanted to write about. But several years ago, before I knew what my second novel was going to be, I encountered a Daily Mail article online that talked about this Russian bird boy case. There was this young child that they had found in a rural area in Russia who was found chirping, and it seemed that he had been raised to believe he was a bird. And, you know, like all feral children's stories, the news item, you know, came in and out very quickly. I mean, people don't tend to pursue these stories very much because they either think they're hoaxes or there's just not much else other than the novelty of the actual story. So I encountered this and I realized there was this great connection to the mythic Zal. And so I basically have a scenario very much like the Russian bird boy. I have my Zal is raised by a crazy elderly woman who doesn't even know she could still have kids. He's the last of many, many children. And he's born in a rural village in Iran around the time of the revolution, though that's very barely alluded to. And so he is actually raised in bird cages in this kind of grand veranda that this older woman has, full of birds of all sorts. And she just adjusts his cage as he grows bigger and older. And he's discovered by one of his siblings who's heard a bit about what's gone on with her mother. And she finds him at age 10, slumped and in a terrible condition in this sort of bird cage. And she rescues him and brings him back into the city, into Tehran. And he eventually becomes quite famous, like the bird boy of the Daily Mail article in a sense, but more so. And then gets rescued by a New York behavioral analyst who brings him to New York City. And then basically the plot really focuses on his coming of age in his 20s and focuses on New York between Y2K to 9/11.
And there's so many parts of the story that I think, you know, we could explore. One thing that comes to mind is just the very notion of storytelling. I mean, your book was inspired by a classic book of stories. And for Zal, I mean, his identity is so wrapped up in this story of being a bird boy. And it's, for him, it seems, you know, everyone he meets, it's a question in his mind. Do they know who I am, that I'm the bird boy? And he doesn't want to tell people that story. He wants to move on beyond it. He seems to want more than anything to be, you know, quote unquote normal, whatever that means for him and for all of us who want to be normal, so-called.
Exactly.
And all those things maybe in some respects, I guess, tie together under the idea of being an immigrant coming to a new country. You have your old story of who you are. You have your new story of who you want to be. I wonder, I mean, was that, I imagine that was a theme you were exploring yourself being an immigrant.
Yeah. I mean, I think being an immigrant in a sense almost feels like a metaphor for just a general state of outsiderness. I think it's a Jean Rhys quote where she says, reading makes immigrants of us all. But I think that the immigrant experience, while it feels so specific and alienating when you're going through it, in a sense, when you come of age, no matter who you are in the world, I think you still have this feeling of being outside what you perceive to be some sort of norm. I don't think any of us feels like, okay, now we've come of age, now we're adults, now we're normal. And in fact, in the course of, you know, book touring and all that, I was amazed by how many people related to the story who didn't have my immigrant background, who didn't have, you know, English as a second language. I've really was quite delighted, in a sense, to understand, you know, how universal the feeling of being an outsider is. So that was, I used a lot of different outsider modes. In that sense, I did borrow some things from speculative fiction too, and I do have this kind of mythic backdrop, because I wanted to constantly remove my story from any sort of norm in order to kind of address the thematics of it.
A lot of the emotions, of course, and I guess in any story, the emotions need to be true for people to relate to it. But, I mean, there's a lot of sadness in the story. There's the childhood abuse. There's, you know, the very real issues of life in New York. I mean, 9/11 is a theme, which is hard to think of in any other way than like a real news event. But then clearly, as you say, you were also deliberately incorporating mythical, fantastical elements.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to take all the imaginative conceits here quite seriously. I wanted to use, I mean, realist modes in order to address the fabulism that you have here. I mean, my favorite sort of magical realism takes its conceits quite seriously. You know, there's never the feeling that this is fake. So I hear my big challenge was to do a mythic retelling of a summer before 9/11, and not just a summer before 9/11, but essentially Y2K to the summer before 9/11. So I had to kind of reinvent this world. Well, luckily, what was great about the realism was that the realism was quite surreal. I mean, if you look at the Y2K narrative, not to mention the 9/11 narrative, it's full of the magical, full of the fabulous, full of the kind of impossible. The fact that, you know, we were so kind of seized by this kind of numerological terror and this belief that the numbers could bring us down and the sort of apocalyptic mythology in the air or in this period, it was sort of perfect for me to want to kind of remove myself from what we could say is real. Even while using, I guess, realism in a sense.
Well, I thought it was interesting that, you know, the few books I've read about 9/11 deal with the aftermath, the fictional books, you know, what life was like afterwards for people. But you chose, as you've explained, to do kind of a foreshadowing story. And I wonder why you chose to approach it from that direction in the years, months, days, and even seconds before the attack.
Well, and, you know, I should say, too, that I do use a lot of post 9/11 consciousness in the pre 9/11 narrative here. So there are things that sort of strategically I've placed a lot of post 9/11 paraphernalia that you wouldn't have really, you know, if you're writing something before 9/11, you wouldn't really know to highlight certain things. So a lot of the paranoias of our time now, I went back and placed in the, because I could, because I'm doing a mythic retelling. But yeah, for the most part, I really focused on this era leading up to the actual event. And I kind of enhanced what I felt to be a sort of organic foreshadowing that was in the air. You can perhaps do that with any big event if you choose. You know, if you look at the timeline of any given moment in history, if you look at the months leading up to it, you can make a case for, wow, there was a lot of tension in the air. With 9/11, it was particularly interesting because I feel like people weren't, or my generation didn't seem to be listening to the news as much as they are now. So we were missing a lot of things. A lot of us didn't know who Osama bin Laden was. A lot of us didn't really understand the workings of the Taliban. So, but we did right after, you know, very much so. So there was a lot I could do, play with the current events of that time, even like small things. Like that summer, there was quite a lot of shark attacks all over the country. And I felt like shark attacks, you know, their actual fact is not necessarily incredibly mesmerizing, but as a metaphor, of course, it's really interesting. So I sort of enhanced some of the events surrounding that to build up the tension, because pretty much when you pick up my book, you pretty much know from the beginning, I think, that it's going to end in 9/11. That's not a spoiler. That was the big tightrope act I had sort of in front of me, was how to write a book where you kind of know where it's going to end, and how do you make that journey worthwhile for the reader. So that was, you know, I didn't want to pretend that wasn't going to happen. My treatment of the event maybe isn't what people anticipate, but I wanted them to know that this is about this finite period right before the period that we're all in right now, the eternal post 9/11 era, you know.
And how did you come upon the idea of having a magician as one of the central figures? Because the title, The Last Illusion, refers to this magician's ambition to do this amazing trick where he makes the Twin Towers, you know, quote unquote, disappear.
Yeah. You know, the big, for me, the other part of the book, what I consider the other half, is really focused around Rand Silber, who is my magician and my illusionist here. And his friendship with Zal was really what gave me the core of this book. And he, you know, talk about surreal and real again. I mean, he was inspired very much by David Copperfield, and particularly an act of David Copperfield that I was very mesmerized by as a young child. Happened to be the same period as a child that I was also very mesmerized by the Book of Kings. So there's this kind of memoiristic impulse behind the weaving of the two threads of the book. But it was in about 1983, David Copperfield had this really kind of magnificent Statue of Liberty disappearing act that was my first live telecast in America that I saw on television, you know, with my family. And that really mesmerized me. I loved it. But it also, like, perplexed me in that I didn't really understand the symbolism behind making the Statue of Liberty disappear. As you know, I was a young immigrant and I was so focused on all symbols of America. And I didn't really understand why you had an audience in New York applauding for the disappearance of the Statue of Liberty, which to me kind of also seemed horrific. And this really stayed with me. And of course, you know, decades later, I was able to access it on YouTube and see it. And I got to read a little bit about it. And I sort of figured out what he was doing. And so in my head, just like I knew I would always write about the Zal of the Book of Kings at some point, I've always thought that I would probably write about David Copperfield's Statue of Liberty disappearing act. But, you know, for me, the big event of my life was, of course, 9/11, and it's something I've written for years about through essays, and it's also figures in my first novel. And so it was very easy for me to transfer the Statue of Liberty with the World Trade Center and to have this illusionist who, unlike David Copperfield, is embarking on his final illusion. And for me, that was going to be a World Trade Center disappearing act instead of Statue of Liberty. So that's where 9/11 kind of comes in more tightly into the plot.
And can you talk a little bit about your experience with 9/11? I know you were living downtown in New York when it happened. I mean, maybe you can talk a little bit about how it's affected you and your interest in turning it into literature and weaving it into your stories.
Yeah, I was living not far from the World Trade downtown, and so I witnessed the thing. I mean, I witnessed the impact of the second plane, and then, you know, just watched the two buildings collapse right in front of my eyes. I had perfect view in this one high rise that I lived in downtown, and very, very soon realized that this was going to be the biggest event of my life. And that it was going to be a big subject that I would end up writing about. I don't know how it wouldn't. I mean, as a creative person, too, the sheer spectacle of it, it's hard to top. I you know, experienced quite a lot of post-traumatic stress from it. I still think about it constantly, much more so than I think a lot of people who didn't witness it firsthand. So it became a big subject for me. I mean, a subject for me in several different ways. You know, one is as a New Yorker, one is just as an American, one is as a Middle Eastern American, you know, which of course complicates things a little bit. So having all these different ways of seeing the event also just, you know, made it interesting for me to write about, both in a nonfiction sense, but also with my fiction too. It's hard to write about the world that we're in today and ignore that reality. And of course, again, this impulse to want to go into the fabulist or the magical realist. I mean, how could I, again, not be sort of tempted by 9/11 in that sense? Not only was the event so surreal, but the way in which it's altered our lives today. I mean, think about it. There's all sorts of things that we do, even ritualistically, that are quite surreal. We've now become used to taking off our shoes when we go on airplanes, or getting rid of liquids, or, you know, all sorts of things around flying, or all sorts of ways in which we think about the sky, or all sorts of issues of security and privacy. These are all, you know, provide quite a lot of fodder for I think, a creative person, not to mention a human who's living in kind of tense and trying times, I guess.
It's true. I mean, and the whole world has been affected. I mean, there are whole movements that we know of. They know changes in the Middle East as a result of the wars that we started, or that, you know, were started after 9/11,
right,
that have changed millions, literally millions of people's lives.
Yeah. I mean, you're going to probably see, I think, a lot of literature, you know, surrounding the Islamic State and ISIS. I mean, think about how so surreal, like video game characters, those guys are. I mean, not to diminish their actual atrocities that they're capable of, but just their presence as characters. I mean, just they're just like comic book villains. And in fact, they take cues from that. They take cues from pop culture and literature and art, and how they sort of spread their terror. So, God, you know, talk about speculative fiction. I mean, what a time for that when you know, our own reality, our very much, you know, mainstream reality leans more towards, you know, that other world than maybe where we were before, what our conception of like normal life was.
You know, I think so much of our of literature, there's so much talk about, you know, having more diverse voices, and that's a subject that's come up with science fiction and fantasy as well as all mainstream literature. And one thing that really strikes me, and you mentioned it, is you having been, you know, someone who had been born in the Middle East and then writing about 9/11, which, you know, is so fraught with potential jingoism, and it seems very important that there be a whole spectrum of voices responding and talking about 9/11 and our response to it and how it's impacted our culture. And I suppose, I imagine that you share that view as well. But I just wonder how your editors responded, or if they're people, readers or critics, or if you personally had any trepidation about being a Muslim American but writing about 9/11 in this way and in the way that you've chosen to do it.
Well, there was always the taboo in the literary world almost immediately after, when you saw the first batch of books about 9/11. I think they were somewhere around 2003. And there was always this idea of too soon. People were always constantly saying too soon. Sorry, my dog is overreacting. It's someone at the door. Anyways, there's this constant feeling of things being too soon. And but I think as a creative person, I just have to ignore that. And as obviously as a journalist, I have to ignore that. And in fact, I've said at times that people should ignore the fact that I was a witness to the event, just like I think they could ignore the fact that I'm even Middle Eastern. I mean, it's a story that the whole world has in common. I get very frustrated when I hear people say things like, well, but more people died in this war, or things are harder in this part of the world. Well, that's true, but it's impossible to deny that this particular event in world history has altered the entire globe more so than any event in current history. So it's a story that everybody has. I'm kind of amazed when I meet people who somehow have deluded themselves into believing that it didn't really affect them, or that the event wasn't that big a deal in their life. Maybe the actual day of wasn't, but their lives have completely been altered, even just economically. I mean, anyone who has a job today has been affected by it. So it's I feel that like it's an event we all share. And so that sort of trepidation about that maybe publishers had, I mean, I have to admit it took over 2.5 years or something to sell this book, whereas my first book took only a few months, and I believe this book is stronger. That trepidation, I'm sure, is about this concept of, yeah, a mythic retelling of 9/11. If I'd done a purely realist take from, say, a Middle Eastern woman's perspective, my guess is it would have sold faster. But this idea that I was using a fabulist mode, you know, a sort of speculative mode and addressing this kind of sensitive world event, and then add to the fact that here I am, you know, a brown person addressing this. That caused, I think, some complications, though, of course, you know, I was writing so many essays about it that people knew me as a sort of chronicler of the event in some sense. But I do think, sure, there is a little bit of that pushback, but there's so many pushbacks for artists in so many senses anyways, that one has to just ignore it and just keep to their vision. And I didn't write this assuming that I was going to have like a bestseller or an audience all over the world. I didn't think this is a book that's for everyone. I've actually been quite surprised by what a diverse group of people have responded to it. And that's been a great joy. But I'm sure for some people, you know, they don't want to read anything about 9/11. They don't want to touch it. They want to move on from it or sort of pretend that it's not a constant presence in their life. But I don't know how you can really do that.
Well, I think this is an important contribution to the literature, as you say, that has been emerging and probably will continue to emerge from now until, you know, till forever, I suppose. And there was one other thing I wanted to ask you about. You know, there's a lot of sadness in this book, and I read an essay you wrote, I think it was a couple of years ago, where you talked candidly about your own experience, and I think it was after the publication of your first book, but your own experience with depression. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering how that dark period, your own personal dark period, informed some of the darkness in this book. I can't imagine that, you know, you could have written this book without having gone through that that difficult time.
Yeah, the book was written in a period of time that you know, the years around it were years where I was very ill, and also I was very, very depressed and anxious. So, and it's funny, you know, the creation of this book came out of quite a lot of pain, though I would also emphasize that there's quite a lot of humor in it, too, but dark humor. And that humor and the dark humor is what that is sort of my own world view. I mean, that's what got me out of a lot of the darkness. But a lot of it was also tied to physical illness, which for me was Lyme disease. So it's very interesting for me to be writing about a protagonist who has had these incredible physical setbacks that had emotional consequences while I myself was going through it. And I was misdiagnosed and undiagnosed and eventually diagnosed, but not until really the book was being published. So maybe that kind of informed a sort of surrealness of the universe too. But I, for instance, knew, and I don't think this is a spoiler, but I'm saying that the end basically is 9/11, but there's also a sort of hidden happy ending within that too. And I really needed this book to have some sort of joy at the end of it, because I felt that I was struggling so hard while I was writing it, that if it didn't, if my Zal didn't get some sort of happy ending, that I couldn't. I mean, I identified with him so much while I was writing it. I don't think I've ever written a character that I identified with more, even though he seemingly seems like my opposite in every sense, from visual to, like, you know, circumstantial. But he's really me in so many ways. So I knew that both humor and some light at the end had to be there. Because, yeah, it did feel like, you know, there was just, in order to tell the story properly and to be faithful to it, I had to grapple with all the darkness. And the darkness, it's hard to not see it, you know, if you're looking at especially Y2K through 9/11 era stuff. And like I said, a lot of the post 9/11 era stuff that went back and put into it.
Well, so what are you working on now? Are you working on another book? Are you focusing on your essays?
Well, I'm always writing essays, so that's always happening. But I'm actually in California right now because I'm kind of going back the setting of a lot of my Lyme disease disintegration. So my third book that we just sold a few months ago to Harper Perennial is a memoir of late stage Lyme disease.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. I'm sort of back where I kind of disintegrated. And I'm doing some research and just writing a lot of that this summer to turn in on time. But yeah, that's the next thing for me. And I do have a fourth book, which is my third novel that I kind of have in the works too, but that's going to take longer, I think.
So you're one of those writers who works through her stuff, through her storytelling, as opposed to someone, and maybe there aren't, is no such thing, but as a writer who just wants to push all that stuff aside and not think about it. Maybe they don't exist.
I think they might maybe exist. I mean, just like readers who really like to read just for escape. I suppose there's writers who like to write just for escape. But it seems so tricky to be such an expert compartmentalizer that you could do that. I mean, I feel really strongly that I'd be one of those people who really couldn't really comfortably stay alive with that writing. So I always have to confront the hard things in order to make sense of them. And that to me is the great function of writing, and the great function of literature is to make meaning out of things that might not otherwise have a sort of meaningful narrative. It helps organize, I think, our sense of the stories that we're made of and the stories outside of. So I have to do it that way. Otherwise, I'm not sure what I would be left with.
And hopefully writers, you know, are performing a service, hopefully, to other people who are struggling trying to articulate their own experiences. And when you write about Lyme disease, then I'm sure lots of people with both that and other illnesses that they've struggled with and perhaps undiagnosed, there's a lot they can relate to. So,
yeah, absolutely. Though it's funny, even with The Last Illusion, I've been so amazed by how many people, you know, even with fiction and a story like this, that you just don't think people would say, wow, this helped me. I've been amazed by the response and people who have felt in so many different ways marginalized coming to me writing or meeting me at readings and saying that, you know, that helped them work through all sorts of issues. So it's funny. I mean, you can have, you know, in a way, Lyme disease in itself can be used as a metaphor for so many different ailments. But I was kind of amazed that my bird boy here in this mythic setting could still create an opportunity for connection with people.
Well, I wish you the best of luck with your future work and, you know, with The Last Illusion. And I really thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
I've been talking with Porachista Kakpor about her novel, The Last Illusion. The paperback came out this year from Bloomsbury. And I invite you to check out my interviews with other authors on the podcast website, www.newbooksinsciencefiction.com, and to subscribe on iTunes or other podcasting sites. We've got a Facebook page, and we tweet at New Books Sci-Fi. I tweet personally at Rob Wolf Books. And my own sci-fi books, The Alternate Universe and The Escape, are on Amazon. Our logo is by Michael Thibodeau, theme music by Michael Aaron. The editor of the New Books Network is Marshall Poe. On upcoming shows, I'll be speaking with some contributors to a collection of science fiction short stories out of Sweden, and also to James Cambius, whose new book, Corsair, came out in May from Tor. I spoke with James last year about his first book, The Darkling Sea, and I loved it, and I'm really looking forward to being dazzled by Corsair as well. Bye for now, and thanks for listening.